seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. When we think about wine, our minds usually travel to faraway places like Italy, Argentina, France, or California. But Wisconsin has its own wine industry. Growers across the state create their own unique varieties with cold hardy grapes that produce a surprising array of flavors with locally grown fruits and honey as well. North Central Wisconsin's wine industry may be modest in scale, but it has roots as old as the state itself. And with more people than ever exploring wineries and enjoying wine tasting, the impact on tourism is increasingly significant. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we explore the wineries of North Central Wisconsin, where growers are producing wines that are the result of centuries of selection, cultivation, and hybridization of many grape varieties. Here, more than 800 acres of grapes each year and honey foraged from Wisconsin's wildflowers produce wine vintages with local flavor and flair, offering ample opportunities to sip and swirl your way through the state. Joining us today is John Hamilton of White Winter Winery in Iron River, here to talk about his handcrafted mead, his ciders, and spirits. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Lenita Delaney from El Maro Vineyards in Trempealeau to talk about her journey from plumber to winemaker and her passion for making phenomenal award-winning wines from cold hardy grapes. Lenita, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you for the invitation.
Your questions are welcome too. Join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. So, Lenita, I'd like to start with you. You were at one time just one of three female master plumbers in Wisconsin. I know you have kept your license, but now you're this award-winning winemaker. Tell me about that journey. How did you get here?
Oh, that was pretty exciting. We went to Italy to watch Laura curl, my daughter curl. And after she was completed, we went to Venice and then to Rome. And in Italy, when people sat down for lunch, they drank wine. And we thought it was pretty unusual, but Coca-Cola was $5 a can and wine was $2 a glass. You drink wine.
Sure.
So then we came home and decided that when I retired, I would plant some grapes and enjoy the vineyard. And it ended up that everybody else wanted to be outside, and I ended up in the winery itself. So I took education to get there.
Okay. Well, John, what about you? When did you first become interested in making wine?
Oh, golly. The interest is actually in making mead. So my family's been into beekeeping for generations, and going through and researching about beekeeping, I always came across these references to mead. And of course, you know, in high school, it was probably a little easier to think about making our own rather than sneaking a keg out of the local liquor store. So that probably spurred the initial interest in making mead. And quite a number of years ago, when we lived down in Kenosha, then we were able to keep bees ourselves and start making mead. Started as a home brewer. A friend of mine showed me a little bit about how to make beer. And then we thought, why not mead? You know, nobody else is doing it. We can do this on a commercial scale. That led to a couple of years, actually, of research and development, literally going from one end of the country to the other to see who was doing it, how they were doing it, why they were doing it, and most importantly, if they were being successful at it. And when we started in 96, we were one of about 20 or so commercial meaderies across the United States.
Wow. Do you think that a lot of people really start by making it at home? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you started that way. Is that kind of a jumping off point, John, for a lot of people who make wine and mead and even brewers?
Yeah, I think it is. People start off with that curiosity. They want to make it at home. They want something different than what they can get at the local liquor store. They want to experiment. They want to play. And I think it's a huge jumping off point.
Sure. Lenita, tell us about the name of your winery, El Maro. Where did that come from?
When we built a winery, we knew we had to come up with some name. And we thought of names like Great River Road, Mountain View, Valley View, things like that. And my husband, who worked as a farmer for many, many, many years, said, well, why don't we use the name of the farm? And the name of the farm was El Morro, which was Elaine, Mark, and Robert. So I looked it up. And in Spanish, El Morro didn't mean anything. But then okay. I was across the grapes from a young man from Mexico, and he started to laugh when I said it. And I went, what? And he laughed because he said where he's from, it's slang, and it means a child you can't control or someone who drank too much and you can't handle them. So we ended up with that name.
Okay. And Lenita, yours is a family business. Who are all the principal players? What are all their roles at El Morro?
Oh, it ended up being perfect because my husband, Mark, was a farmer. And when we went to Oregon, we met with a vineyard person that said, if you're not a farmer, you'll never make it. I don't know, John, what your background is, but Mark's was farming. And so he knew that you had to work from sunup to sundown and sometimes a lot later. And so he felt comfortable with it. My daughter was a biochemistry major at UW-Madison. So she does a lot of the chemistry and the lab setups and hires the people that work in the lab. My son was a graduate of Stout with hotel restaurant management. He handles the tasting room and does an excellent job in the tasting room. And Laura's husband, Todd, is with us, and Todd had a degree in marketing and worked for Budweiser as a distributor for many years, so he knew everything about distribution that we didn't know. And so me being a master plumber, I just fit in with doing the plumbing in the building, doing the plumbing for the tanks, all that kind of stuff.
Sounds great. John, as you said, you focus on mead, so can you explain for our listeners what mead is and how is it different from other wine?
Sure. So mead, oldest fermented beverage in the world, actually the oldest unknown fermented beverage in the world, made from honey as the base fermentable sugar. So it has roots in virtually every single culture of the world. You just pick your spot, pick your time period, and we can usually, you know, tell you where, you know, where it was focused on that particular time. So there's lots of different styles of mead, just like there's lots of different styles of grape wines or fruit wines. We have everything from dry to sweet. We have every bit of as much of a terroir as grape wines do, because the bees come from and work a specific area, floral or nectar sources, and you can pick that out in the honeys that we get. And it's very interesting, because some of the traditional meads, which are just honey and water that have been fermented, are more of a early season Dutch white, clover, basswood. They're almost water white, very light in flavor, really, really nice. Then we get some of the later season honeys that tend to be more of the late season wildflowers, goldenrod, that type of thing, the flowers you see on the side of the road in the fall after all the heat. I tend to have a little heavier of that characteristic honey flavor, and those we use typically in our meads that are made with fruit, that are in technical mead jargon called a melomel. That darker later season honey tends to stand up against the fruits a little bit better than the early season light honey does. So
there's mead that is just honey, and then there are combinations that you make.
Yep. So several combinations. So the traditional is just honey and water. The melomels that are made with fruit. Cider is another category that's made with fresh pressed apple cider and honey. You can have meads that are called metheglins that are made with specific herbs. So that's the metheglin is the root word of the word medicine. So those were in ancient times typically used for treating different ailments. Piment is a style of mead made with grape. So lots of different styles.
Okay. Lenita, how did you go about choosing which grapes to plant for your wines? How did you do that research and come up with what to do?
Well, when originally the University of Minnesota had recommendations for what grapes to plant, and they were the easiest ones to tend, actually, their first ones. And then after that, you go to conferences, you talk to people who are in the industry, like John, and ask them what is selling, what's a good grape to have. And grapes have a terroir, just like everything else. And there are some grapes that enjoy living here and some grapes that don't like to live here. So we picked out grapes that we hoped would enjoy living here and that met the requirements or the recommendations of other folks. And then we make wine out of it, and we do sample batches usually, and we decide, do we like the way that turned out or don't we? And then we modify when we pick the grapes, because we do monitor the grapes all the time for when they're picked, because they change, just like wine, they change daily as to what kind of wine they're going to make and how they're suited for that. So we monitor grapes when they get close to ripeness.
It sounds like a lot of trial and error. Is that accurate?
It sounds like a lot of research and trial and error.
Okay.
In many ways, Wisconsin is still really in its infancy as a wine industry. And like Lenita said, she hit the nail right on the head. You know, you got to find out what works here. And sometimes that might take several years. It might take several generations. It might, you know, you just don't know. But it's a process of trying and weeding out, no pun intended, you know, how all those things fit for our climate.
So constant testing, constant trying new things. How long does it take from planting those grapes to the first batch, Lenita?
The planting the grapes is year one, and usually they're 1 year old rootstock then. And then from that point, it takes another 3 to 5 years before you get a full harvest. And in this area, it depends on the drought. That would have an impact. The polar vortex had a huge impact on many grapes in Wisconsin, because they were designed to take down to a certain temperature, and the polar vortex of winter before last was very damaging for many grapes. In fact, there are several wineries north of us that I know have pulled out their grapes because of that winter.
Okay. So, John, you at White Winter Winery, you have other products besides mead. So what else do you produce there?
Right. So we focus on what's grown in our region, and we live in some of the best apple growing country in the state, and right out of the Bayfield Peninsula. So we do ciders, and we've done ciders way before ciders were cool, for probably 23 out of our 25 years or 24 out of our 25 years. And we also make distilled spirits from some of our base meads and ciders.
Okay, John Hamilton of White Winter Winery and Lenita Delaney from El Morro Vineyards, our guests today as we explore the world of Wisconsin-made wine and mead and the impact on local tourism. Your questions for our guests are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Lenita Delaney and John Hamilton are our guests today for a discussion on locally produced wine and mead and what makes those products so unique. We'd like to hear your questions too. Email us at route51 or at wpr.org, or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. John, I see on your website that White Winter Winery uses locally grown ingredients. Do you produce them all yourself, or do you have partnerships with other growers that help with that?
No, I work enough. I don't need to make any more work for myself. As Lenita said, you know, if you're not a farmer, don't go into the business. And there's an old saw in the industry that either you grow fruit or you make wine, but you don't do both very effectively. So we focus on trying to buy as much as we can and support our local infrastructure, farming and infrastructure, agricultural infrastructure. We get a lot of fruit. 70,000-80,000 pounds in fruit or fruit equivalent in cider right out of the Bayfield Peninsula. We get honey out of the New Auburn area. Chippewa Falls area. We've just started getting honey now more regionally over into the Minnesota area because we haven't been able to source enough as close to home as we'd like to. When we first started, we were able to say, oh, we get about 95% of our ingredients within about 50 miles of the shop. But as we've grown over the last 25 years, we can't say that anymore. So we probably do about 65 to 75% within about 250 miles now. So we still try to keep it as regional as we can.
Sure. Lenita, tell me about the first time you ever tasted a wine you made yourself. What did that feel like?
That was pretty funny. And as John said, a lot of people start as home winemakers. And so someone asked Mark and I to make some wine for their wedding. So we actually made a faux ice wine or a pretend ice wine for someone's wedding. And we tasted that. My husband likes wines of different types. So we tried, you know, a Merlot and all sorts of vinifera type wines from kits before we started building our own. And plus, we had a consultant by the name of Paul Gospodarczyk, who is now an instructor at Napa Community College.
Okay. When most people think about wine, I mean, my mind, when I think about wine, doesn't automatically go to Wisconsin. You think about Napa, or you think about, you know, Sonoma, Argentina, France. But John, what do you say to those like so-called wine snobs that think that good wine and mead cannot possibly come from Wisconsin?
You know, that's a really good question. We get that kind of idea sometimes, less so recently, that wine can't be made in Wisconsin. And it's just simply not true. So people who really know wine, though, that doesn't stop them. People who really know wine are curious people. They're intelligent people. They like to experiment. They like to reach out. They like to try different things. And Lenita probably sees the same thing in her tasting room too, where those are the people who will come in and go, wow, this is really cool. Let me see what you're doing. What do you got? You know, let me try it. And they may try something and they'll say, you know, that's too sweet. That's not quite to my taste, but let me try this one instead. So then we shift them over into something that's a little drier. So they're willing to try. They may not be dry wine drinkers. They may not be sweet wine drinkers, but we can usually find something that they enjoy and that they like. And the key, I think, in Wisconsin is not that we're not trying to be California wineries in Wisconsin. And believe me, in northern Wisconsin, we're really not trying to be that because we can't grow that fruit up here. We just can't. So we use what's in our own backyard. And I think that's the key, is making a high quality product with the resources that are available to us. So can we make good wine here? Absolutely. Can we make internationally recognized wines here? Yes, absolutely. As evidenced by Lenita's award shelf, as evidenced by Wellersheim's award shelf, by my award shelf, by so many other wineries award shelves in the state, where we're competing against other wines from all across the nation and all across the world.
Lenita, what are your thoughts on that? What do you say to the wine snob that comes into El Morro and they think, you know, maybe your wine is not going to measure up?
I always ask people what they like, and we do list residual sugar on our tasting guide, but we've had people come in, and most of our wine ships to California. And I think John hit it when he said that people who are wine snobs are usually willing to adventure, to try something new. And I think that's why we do ship so much to California, is because they're kind of tired of the same type of wine that they get mm-hmm. every day. Next week I'm going to the Willamette Valley. And that's notable in Oregon for Pinot Noir. Well, people out there, they're kind of tired of Pinot Noir. They're tired of what they see every day. But they really enjoy coming to Wisconsin and trying a mead, because we do have that ability to build ciders and meads. And our grapes are much different than the grapes in California. They have a hard time with acid. And our acid is higher, and our pHs are lower than what they have in California or Italy or France. And so we have no problem getting the fruit out of the wine with the acidity that we carry. In fact, we do ship some juice to California so they can blend it with theirs in order to bring the acidity up. So the wine snobs, most of the time, it just takes picking their tastings that they want and they're sold.
John, take me through the tasting experience at White Winter Winery. If I come to your winery, I want to do a tasting. What happens?
Oh, man, that's a big question.
I realize that.
Because everybody's a little different. So the first thing we're going to do is when you walk in the door, you're going to see the sign on the top of the door, above the door, that says enter as strangers and leave as friends. And that is absolutely our first goal. Enter as strangers and leave as friends. And we're going to ask you if you've been in there before, if you know anything about mead, and then we start the education process, because there's a lot of people who maybe have heard a reference to mead in the literature, you know, from college English class, Beowulf or whatever, or Harry Potter or the 13th Warrior or whatever. Thank God for Harry Potter, I'll tell you what. So it's been a great thing. And then we educate people on what it is, the different varieties, levels from dry to sweet and everything in between, the spirits, the ciders, you know, and try to help field their questions and point them in a direction where their taste starts. And then we start from there, whether that's dry or sweet or somewhere in between. You know, you can ask basic questions like, if they say, well, I don't know. I drink lots of different things. And then we ask them questions about, do you like chocolate? Or do you like coffee? And if you like coffee, do you like your coffee with cream and sugar, or do you like it black? And that, all those questions, you know, do you like milk chocolate or dark chocolate? And if you like dark chocolate, do you like the really dark chocolate or not so dark chocolate? So that helps point us in a direction of where to start them in that, on that tasting sheet, that tasting journey. The journey.
That's so
of
interesting. Yes, that's so interesting to think about the relationship between those tastes and mm-hmm. and what you produce. So, Lenita, what is it like at El Morro? What can people expect when they visit and they want to have a tasting? And I know things might be a little bit different right now because of the COVID pandemic.
Yes, we did make it through the pandemic, which was an adventure. And we did start with the individual mini bottles, like the 2-ounce bottles for tasting, rather than pouring into each person's glass because of the pandemic. And we have maintained, still have the little bottles. And so if someone comes in and looks, they're first greeted, and then they can decide to sit on the patio and look at Minnesota, or they can stay where we are inside the building. And so then they choose one of the flights. They might like sweet. They might like dry. They might like all 9 different wines that we have in a flight. We actually make, I think, 36 different kinds of wine right now. But people choose flights. And then they can take the flight with a disposable glass and crackers that are prepackaged right now out to their table. And there they can take their mask off and enjoy their flight and look and order cheese plate if they want, order other wines if they want. Saturdays are an adventure because mm-hmm. it's a lot of bachelorette parties and it's a lot of groups coming in on Saturdays. And so my favorite day is Sunday. I always say Sunday drinkers are the best. I mean, they're the real wine snobs too. John probably has the same experience with Sundays.
Yep. Is that true, John?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a little more laid back. Just, you know, people are cruising and they're just looking to put their feet up, so to speak, and enjoy.
Sure.
Yeah. Great analogy, Lenita.
Lenita, when someone's tasting wine at home without the benefit of having you there as a guide, what's the best way to do it?
One of the problems with tasting wine at home is you open a bottle, and usually it's 750 milliliters. And then you go, oh, I don't like this wine. And what do you do with the rest? You know, what happens? But when you're tasting wine at home, you almost have to rely on the wholesaler or the retail store to tell you what this bottle is like. A lot of people buy by labels, but it's really hard to know what it is without visiting somebody's like John's place or our place or another place where you can try fresh wine. And believe me, that makes a difference. Fresh wine. I always say, if you like it when you taste it in the winery, don't save it. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's going to age, if you like it, then drink it when you get home, you know, within a 6 months of time. Don't try to age it for years, because it's not going to taste the same as what you tried. So tasting wine at home is difficult because you do have to open a whole bottle. I think that's the hardest.
What do you think people should look for? You swirl it around. When you swirl it in the glass, what are you looking for? That the, you know, should the wine kind of stick to the glass? What's a sign that this is a good quality wine?
John.
Oh, you know what, Lenita? I thought maybe you could answer that question since you're doing the wine tastings, at least normally at Elmira.
Yeah, we do have some. We did virtual wine tastings during COVID where people were home with their wines, and we'd tell them, you know, the glass shape of a wine glass is made intentionally to show the wine the best. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they have stems. The stems aren't just for looks or to make them easier to knock over. The stems actually keep the wine at the correct temperature for tasting, because when it's served to you, it's the correct temperature. But if you hold on to the bowl, just like a brandy snifter, if you hold on to the bowl, you can heat it. But then when you swirl it, what you're doing is coating the inside of that tulip-shaped glass with wine, so it volatilizes the aromas or bouquets of that wine so that you can really get what you want out of it. And you would stick your nose in the bowl and sniff. And when you taste the wine, you will want to actually slurp, like you've seen on television or a movie, maybe somebody slurping soup, something like that, where you get some air with it, and then that combines with the wine. And so a lot of people will smell a wine at our winery and go, oh, this wine smells sweet. And I go, you know, you can't really smell sweet, but it reminds you of something you've had in your past that was sweet with that aroma. And the legs on a glass can mean many different things. It can mean higher alcohol. It can mean higher sugar. It can mean higher glycerin content. So you never know exactly what the legs mean without, you know, tasting it or having someone inform you what those legs are. But
so John, when people are tasting mead, what kind of glass shape are they supposed to use with mead?
Oh, get a flagon, fill it up, and slam it down. I'm kidding.
does it matter
this
much?
This is the mead hall. No, it matters, and I think Lenita hit it right on the head. You know, we do, and even in the cellar, we do a lot of organoleptic testing, which is just a fancy word, big fancy word for that. We get to smell and taste a lot. And we tell people that too. You know, when you're at the tasting bar, smell, taste. You know, she when she was talking about, you know, smelling sweet. Yeah, you're right. You don't smell sweet. You associate sweet with other things. And so we try to help people make those connections. And it's definitely a process. And it's a process that we've noticed that a lot of people who enjoy food and will enjoy tasting meads or wines or ciders or whatever, because it's a conscious effort of paying attention to what you're putting in your mouth and what aromas are coming into your nose, and enjoying that and taking the time, slowing down. Like Lenita said, Sunday sippers are sometimes the most interesting because they take the time to stop.
What about alcohol concentrations? I mean, are there, what accounts for the different alcohol concentrations in different products, different wines, different meads? And Do you list those? I mean, do you tell people what those alcohol concentrations mm-hmm. are, John?
Yep, we sure do. And part of that's a legal thing, but we would do that anyway, because you want to be cognizant of what you're drinking and then where you're going afterwards if you're hopping in a car. So really the alcohol concentrations are a function of how much sugar, whether that sugar is in the form of some kind of, you know, fruit sugar like the grape juice or honey or any other fruit sugar. And then how far down you ferment that, whether you leave some of that residual sugar in the wine, in the finished product, or you ferment it all out. So you start off with higher sugar content, ferment it all out, you're going to end up with a higher alcohol content. You start off with a high sugar content, ferment only part of it out, you're going to wind up with a moderate alcohol and a little bit of residual sweetness in that finished product.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah. It does. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So how does distribution work at White Winter Winery? How do you get your products out?
Well, after 25 years, I'm still trying to figure that out. So we probably sell about 70% or so right out the front door. And we're heavily, you know, we're in a tourist business. We're in a tourist-based area, so we're heavily touristed. So a lot of that, a lot of those sales happen in about 75 days or so in summer. We do have distribution across the state of Wisconsin and into Minnesota, and then we sell direct to consumers in the states that we can legally ship into.
And Lenita, what about you? How does distribution work for you at Almara? I know that you have a wine club, and you said earlier that you ship a lot of wine to California.
Right. We used to ship with our own licenses. Now we use Vino Shipper. And Vino Shipper is a company that will ship to every state, almost a lot more states than we could. But it can't ship to California because it's based there. And it can't ship to Wisconsin because we're based here. So we still carry our California license and do shipping in Wisconsin ourselves because of those two things. And we're about 50-50, 50% in the tasting room, 50% on the shelves at the stores. Shelves in the stores are great advertising. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful because people look at your label and they say, you know, it's really pretty, but I'd like to go there and see what it's really like there. And so we get a lot of people from that too.
You're listening to John Hamilton of White Winter Winery and Lenita Delaney from El Maro Vineyards. They're our guests today as we continue our discussion on the impact and lure of locally produced wine and mead. Your questions for our guests are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at route51@wpr.org. When calling us, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Lenita Delaney and John Hamilton are our guests today for a discussion on the wineries in our region and the unique products they create. We'd love to hear your questions too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone by calling 800-780-9742. Lenita, what are some of the most surprising combinations that have turned into really incredible wines for you?
Black currant probably is a big one. In France, it's called cassis, but we blended it with Frontenac Gris grapes, and we ended up with a wine called Currant Affair with an A, and it's got lips on it, and it's kind of popular around Valentine's Day, of course. That was an unusual combination, and then it's amazing to me how some grapes, I imagine it works the same with honeys, you can combine and it tastes good, and other ones you can't. They don't go together. It's like a puzzle, and you have to find out what you can do with a grape.
John, what about you? Did you ever have anything that really surprised you that maybe turned out better than you thought or worse than you thought it would?
Well, worse is a pretty common thing. After 25 years, we've made some pretty bad stuff. And hopefully that all stays in the cellar, you know, gets transferred over into the still and makes a fine spirit at some point down the line. But let me think here now. Combinations. We're pretty straightforward in what we make. I think I would agree with Lanita. Blackcurrant is certainly a popular one. And it's actually the bane of my mead making existence because currants themselves are full of citric acid, which is a real challenge to deal with in the wine cellar. So there's grapes that have and fruits that have a lot of acid, malic or tartaric, which are there's methods for dealing with that, but citric acid is a little more challenging. So
we have Joe on the line from Star Lake. Joe, thanks for calling Route 51.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Thank you. I'm enjoying the show. And when my wife and I were in Europe, we're musicians, we tour, we talked to people about the French vineyard owners that were starting to buy land in England because of the impacts of global warming. And so I'm fascinated by changes that anyone has seen, you know, here in Wisconsin and how people are predicting out 10, 15 years in terms of, you know, the production of these fruits. So that's my question.
Thank you. Lanita, I saw you nodding your head. Maybe you'd like to address that for Joe.
Yes, Joe. We also have looked at global warming and how it impacts. In fact, you can see it this summer where we had the hottest temperatures we've ever had and also drought. And then all of a sudden we get a lot of rain and hopefully the rain hits at the correct period, like before veraison, which is the color change in grapes or the softening of the white grapes. It's okay to have rain. And where we live, we can take an inch a week. But when the rain comes at the wrong time, like when the grapes are ready, then it can be troublesome because the harvest is impacted by when you harvest. In fact, you can't say, I'll harvest next week. It's no problem. With grapes, you harvest the day they're ready. And it's really important. And that with global warming can change tremendously. Now, will we ever be able to plant the same grapes they can in California because it's going to warm here? I've heard rumors that the trees in our area won't be able to accommodate the changes as quickly as they need to. And that could happen. But I think the grapes are designed to adapt to almost everything because they are sisters of the wild grape. All our grapes are in Wisconsin. And so I think they can adapt to a lot. And anybody who's ever had a grapevine in their yard or beside their yard knows how hard they are to kill.
That's so true. John, I'm curious about location, since we're talking about location and we're talking about, you know, how you choose the right things for your particular climate. How did you choose northern Wisconsin as the perfect location for your winery, or were you already there and you chose products that fit?
Yeah.
Chicken or the egg question.
Choose? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that there was a lot of conscious thought that way. It's because we lived there, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we knew we weren't going to grow grapes in the north, or at least not where we are. And we knew for sure we weren't going to grow vinifera grapes up here. So there are certain areas around the Bayfield Peninsula that it's a small, about 12 mile or so microclimate where they're starting to grow some of the cold hardy fruits, cold hardy grapes, and with some success, which is why we started making mead. Not only is it because of the historical connection for me and my family, but it also meant that we could ferment something that was really unique. It was very local and we could take advantage of all those local fruits to blend and make some really unique products.
I'd like to ask you both what wines and wine styles are the most popular right now at each of your wineries. Lanita, let's start with you. What are people really wild about right now?
Well, we actually had a wine called West Prairie White in a competition in a suburb of Los Angeles at Long Beach, California. And it won the Chairman's Award or the Best of Class Award or the Best White Wine Award out there. And they were shocked. They said, a Wisconsin winery winning best white wine? It was unbelievable. And I think that even when we went to California, people talk dry, but they drink sweet, a lot of people. So our best-selling wines are the sweet wines, either sweet whites, sweet reds. That's what people like.
Well, congratulations on that award, and way to represent Wisconsin in California. That's great. John, what about you? What is the most popular thing that you're finding at White Winter Winery right now?
Yeah, just like Lenita, people talk dry, drink sweet. And we are in northern Wisconsin, so it's even more sweet. We probably sell sweet mead, which is along the lines of Moscato in terms of sweetness, probably 2-to-1 or more over everything else. And then our semi-sweet, the Sizer, which is probably closest in representation to a late harvest Riesling, would probably be one of our next best sellers. So you'll hear me talk a lot about and give comparisons to grape wines. And it's not that we have an identity crisis so much as grape wines are kind of like chicken to us. So you have frog legs, you have ostrich meat. What's it taste like? Chicken, right? So we try to give people some frame of reference because people are used to grape wines. They're used, you know, you're used to talking about Pinots or Merlots or whatever. They're familiar with that. So it's just like with that tasting sweet. You don't taste sweet, you associate sweet. So we try to help give people an association with something that they're familiar with, so it helps direct their tasting experience.
Lenita, a big part of the wine experience is pairing wine with the appropriate food, or food that really complements the wine, or vice versa. How do you go about recommending food pairings for the wines you produce? Is that something that's part of the tasting experience at your vineyard?
Actually, there is probably on the internet, and there's a book called What to Drink with What You Eat. It includes beer and mead and wines and actually liquors and water and anything, any kind of beverage. But there are books that tell you what you're probably going to want to drink with what you eat. Now, that doesn't always work because those are all usually vinifera wines and ours are cold climate wines. So that doesn't work. But when people come in, they'll say, what's your favorite wine? And I'll say, what am I eating? Because it makes a difference. What you eat does impact the flavor of the wine.
Sure. And John referred to questions visitors are asked when they come to the winery. One was about dark chocolate, for example. What's the connection or recommendation for someone who likes dark chocolate, John? I mean, what do you tell them?
Everything. Dark chocolate with everything. Sorry.
I love dark chocolate.
Try not to get too serious about stuff. But the raspberry mead with dark chocolate is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it's just phenomenal. So we have... like the Sizer I mentioned earlier, made with fresh pressed apple cider and honey, very similar to a late harvest Riesling. Excellent with spicy foods, a good aged Wisconsin sharp cheddar, like a 7-year. It's fantastic. The black meat on the drier end, great with lamb, grilled salmon, smoked meats and fish. It's excellent with barbecue, all that good stuff. There's just so many different food pairings if you pick something. The dry mead is a traditional mead, just honey and water, fermented out, but just off dry, very light, very floral. It's fantastic with poultry, seafood, or just a nice green salad.
That sounds delicious. You're making me hungry just talking about all these wonderful combinations. Yeah. So how do you choose what combinations to make? How do you find new things, John? I mean, you must be constantly looking for new combinations or new flavors.
Yep. Well, and again, first and foremost, we're trying to use what's in our own backyard. We're trying to make sure that we're focusing on supporting that local agricultural community. So that's kind of where we start. And you'll see lots of variations on a theme. And the experiments, like we did an experiment with a dry blueberry mead, where it was just simply the blueberries and honey to bring up the Brix or the sugar content in that initial must mix, and treated it a lot like a red grape wine. So we fermented on the skins, did some really interesting stuff with it. It came out really fun. It was excellent. We enjoyed it. We only made 60 gallons of it because it was a play thing. And we'll probably do it again on a much larger scale. And those are the things that I find really, really exciting back in the wine cellar, is to be able to play with some of that stuff and experiment with different styles and different flavors.
So, Lenita, what kind of role does your winery play in the tourism industry in your area? Is it a big draw? Does it bring a lot of people to the area?
Well, being from a very small town, it makes it a very important draw for the area. If we were from a big city where there were many things to do and touristy things, that would be different. But we're from an area where the local towns are 1,000 people, and we live right between the refuge and the state park. So people that are vacationing visit us when the weather's not as good to go out in a kayak or in a canoe or fishing. They'll come to the winery.
Yeah, we love rainy days.
I would imagine that's when they all come out, right, John?
Yeah, yeah.
What role does your winery play in the Northwoods tourism industry, John? I mean, what's the impact economically? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, like Lenita said, in a small town, it's huge because we bring lots of people in. And I just pulled out my copy of our Winery Association survey or impact study that we did back in 2015. And here's just a little snippet. In 2015, the states at that time, 98 wineries, experienced 1,780,918 visits by guests. Approximately half of those were on an overnight trip. The total tourism spending was about $152 million. Now, this is in 2015. We've got like 100, what is it, Lenita, 150, 135 wineries now, I think, in the state. It's huge. Probably about 90, 80 or 90 of those are members of the Wisconsin Winery Association. So if this is in 2015, imagine how much it is now. I mean, it's huge. 1,000 to 1,700 full-time equivalent employees that we support. It's not a small thing. And it brings in revenue not only to the towns, you know, we help other businesses with tourism, heads and beds, helping to fill those beds in the Airbnbs or hotels, motels, filling the seats in the restaurants, all that kind of stuff. It all makes a difference. And we all work together, you know, within our communities to try and support each other and bring everybody up. You know, the rising tide floats all boats.
Sure. So things have changed a lot over the years. You said how things have grown so much, more and more wineries in the area. And John, you're celebrating the winery's 25th anniversary this summer. I'm curious, what are you doing differently now compared to when you first started?
Oh man, that's a big question. Well, you know, we try to make sure that we're focusing on our local community. We try to make sure that we are helping our local community. We try to make sure we're buying from our local community and reaching out to people. So July 3rd is the day. Come on up and help celebrate.
Wonderful. Lenita, I actually want to ask you both just briefly, what do you wish more people knew about Wisconsin wines, Lenita?
I wish people would try them, especially with food, and they'd find out how great they can be.
And what about you, John? When you are communicating with people, what do you wish more people would know about the wines that are produced here and the meads that you produce as well?
That they're all really, really good. And it doesn't matter if you've had one type of wine from one place and the same thing from another place, every one of them is going to be different. Every one of them is going to express a different flavor, a different aroma, a different face, so to speak, and just try it. Just go ahead and try it. The wineries are a perfect spot to do that. You don't have to spend the money on a whole bottle. You can try a sample. You can see what you like and what you don't. So just try it.
I want to thank you both for being here. This has been a great discussion. That is all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Once again, a big thanks to our guests, John Hamilton of White Winter Winery and Lenita Delaney from El Morro Vineyards. Our producer today is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at wpr.org/route51. Next week, tune in for a discussion with three area musicians who will share their thoughts on the return to live music and some of their original songs with us. Until then, we're heading out of town.